As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to talk again to Imam Tom. Welcome back, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Always a pleasure, Paul. Great to be back together.
Great to have you back. Imam Tom Fulkini converted to Islam in 2010, a year before he finished his BA in political science from Vassar College. He studied at the Islamic University of Medina, from where he obtained his BA from the Faculty of Sharia. Imam Tom is currently the Research Director of Islam and Society at the Yakin Institute for Islamic Research, and he also teaches tafsir and Islamic history online through Legacy International Online High School. Now, as you will know, Imam Tom has kindly agreed to discuss the books that have made a significant difference to him intellectually, and today he'll continue his discussion of this book, Restating Orientalism, A Critique of Modern Knowledge by Wael Hallaq. That's the tome there, published by Columbia University Press. Hallaq, if you don't know, is professor of in the humanities at Columbia University in the States, where he has been teaching ethics, law, and political thought since 2009. And he is considered a leading scholar in the field of Islamic legal studies and has been described as one of the world's leading authorities on Islamic law. So over to you, sir.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, salatu salam, rasulillah. Thank you for having me back. It's always a pleasure and a privilege to be with you. And a quick note and of translation for our UK folks, that in the US, college is used also for university. They're not quite interchangeable, but a college is basically a smaller university. But they are at the same level. I know that's a very confusing thing, a difference in usage between
apparently, if you're like an assistant professor in the US, that's equivalent to our just being a lecturer in Britain. I mean, they're the same level. There's confusion.
There's no standardization. No. This is a special Ramadan edition of Blogging Theology, which was a unique opportunity, because even though we're probably a little bit tired and maybe not as articulate as normal, there's more time. And so I was able to, like you, I've been busy with a lot of other things, especially in the wake of what's going on in Palestine and the electoral year that is facing both of us in the UK and the US. But yeah, Ramadan has opened up more time, alhamdulillah. So I was able to sit down just, I think, yesterday or the day before and jot some notes down. So glad that we're able to get back on this. We're entering today's discussion is going to be on chapter one, and it will pretty much be limited to chapter one, but it's an important chapter because Hallaq is basically going to take down the theory of Orientalism proposed by Edward Said. He's going to demonstrate its limits, its weaknesses, its fuzziness, its incoherence, and that will set up the rest of the book. Now, he's not his purposes, and he makes this clear later, are not to, poo-poo Saeed or to sort of do anything of that nature. No, in fact, he wants to, as he described, I think, in the intro, to hijack Saeed's ship and take it to an even higher level. Yeah. He thinks that, and I think he's very, very astute to point out that Saeed had commitments, liberal commitments, secular commitments, modern commitments, that prevented him from seeing certain things and prevented him from theoretically grasping certain things. So as my advisor at Vassar College told me when I was, when me and some friends were submitting a paper, you might have had a glimpse of what was problematic about a certain structure of thought. But if you don't really drill down on what it is, you end up just throwing a rock at it instead of demolishing the entire thing. And I think that's an apt sort of summary of how Halaq sees Saeed's Orientalism, that he sensed something was wrong. His Palestinianness, he could not avoid sensing something that was very, very wrong. But because of other commitments that he had, his theoretical outlook was very, very limited, and he couldn't see clearly what it is that he was really trying to critique. So Halaq is basically putting glasses on Saeed and saying that this is what you're really looking at. This is the structure of it. This is where it begins. This is where it ends. This is how it works. And this is how you destroy it. Now, what's going to be really interesting is that when you see the particular nature of Saeed's limitations, you can actually trace them to his own sort of philosophical and metaphysical commitments, which are rooted in secular liberalism and secular humanism. But we'll get there. So to begin the chapter, Halaq introduces a couple questions to drill down on or to illustrate the incoherence of Saeed's theory of Orientalism. So the two questions that he asks are, when and where is colonialism in Saeed's Orientalism, right? When is colonialism? When did it take place? And where is it? What's the arena? What's the area that it took up? And he pulls quotes. I'm not going to go into such detail that I'm going to pull quotes, but for Saeed, colonialism is sort of an amorphous, fuzzy thing. The project that Saeed takes on in his Orientalism and follows it up with culture and imperialism, to him, is a project of infinite scale. It's an endless project. It's not something that is a modern issue. When he talks about Orientalism, and because of his definition and understanding of what Orientalism is, he understands it as being something that he starts talking about the Greeks. He starts talking about things before European colonization. He goes all over the place, right? This to Halaq is a mistake, and it's because of his inability to drill down on what exactly is the structural nature of Orientalism and what even is the structural idea of what colonialism is in the first place, right? As we've talked, I think, in other editions or videos that we've done, colonialism had different waves or it had different eras. The early stage of European colonization in the late 14 and 1500s and even the 1600s, even stretching into the 1700s, was on a more classical style of domination. Yes, it was aided with things such as racism. A really good book, by the way, though it has limitations, but a really good book to demonstrate the shifting nature of colonialism itself is Ugly Freedoms by Elizabeth Anker. Halaq actually cites this book and talks about it in some detail. It's got some limitations, it's coming from a very sort of like progressive sort of background, but it does a really interesting job in showing how chattel slavery and the North Atlantic slave trade got going before the ideology of sort of racialization of that slavery firmly took hold, and actually traces this in the law. So in the legal status of slaves in, say, Barbados or in the Caribbean, that initially it was a little bit fuzzy and quite wide, the net or the scope of who could be enslaved and what was their status and things like that. But then in the 1600s, it got castified. It got, formulated.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Ironically, and this is one of the best parts of the book that you would appreciate, Paul, John Locke was essential to that.
Yeah.
So she goes into detail on John Locke and his unique contributions to the racialization of chattel slavery. And
yeah, then, he was very much involved in, I forget, was it the Virginia Slaveholding Company or whatever. This is a state royal kind of organization in England. And the irony is he's the seen as the founder of modern liberalism, you know, preaching tolerance and equality and all the rest of it. And right. Yet he was actively involved and personally benefited from financially the slave trade, believe it or not, in the United States, well, it wasn't the United States then, but the colonies, as we still sometimes call them in England, actually, in North America. But yeah, absolutely. It's a great irony. Yeah.
Or not ironic if we understand liberalism properly.
Well, indeed, but this is
on brand. So, you know, the interesting about Anchor is that Anchor shows that the person that Locke is theorizing in his first treatise, second treatise, all these sorts of things about freedom and individual autonomy, stuff like that, it's the freedom of the slaveholder. Yeah. It's the freedom of the landowner.
Yeah.
In the like very explicit distinction to the slave. Now, what's interesting about that book, and I won't go on too much of a tangent here, is that not only does he benefit from it, not only does he base his theorization of the liberal self on the slave master, but then he codifies it into law in Barbados, and then he exports that codification to South Carolina. So he was the one who participated in drawing the Constitution of South Carolina, which coincidentally happens to be the colony where the majority of, or at least a larger number of Muslim slaves was taken. So there's a direct line from Locke and sort of the racialization of slavery and the codification of that into law, and then actually making it into the codification of law in the United States and the founding of the nation.
And it wasn't just him. People like John Stuart Mill, the English philosopher, economist, and whatever. Again, one of the great proponents of classical liberalism in his book on liberty, for example, is quite clear that his notions of liberty and so on really only apply to white people.
And you
have to read it to believe it, really. The others are only fitively for authoritarian regimes and despotic regimes. So this idea of liberalism as a natural universal ideology is certainly not there in the great classical theorists, whether it be Locke or John Stuart Mill in the 19th century.
Yes, wonderful. Which is exactly our point here with Halak, is that colonialism becomes liberal in the real sense, not in the fake sort of veneer sense. That what begins as resource extraction, domination, territorial, you know, there's the colony and the center and you know, the sort of economic relationship. evolves under secular liberalism to be something much more, something even unique, right? Which has to do, and we're talking about the high period of colonialism in the 19th century and then onward, where the fully mature colonialism is something that the world has never seen. Where, and this is something that's essential to Halakh, both in Impossible State and in Restating Orientalism, and we've said it before when we went through Impossible State, that modern violence is unique, and the European colonization is unique. Not back in the 1600s necessarily, but once we get to the 1800s, the 1830s, especially the 1850s and onwards, it is absolutely unique in that it's no longer just the simple subjugation and domination of land, resources, and bodies, but it is the conquering of the inside. It's the destruction of worldviews. It's the elimination of knowledges. It is structural genocide, right? People are now, they're more aware of these terms because of what's going on in Palestine right now and in Gaza. You know, we talk about epistemic genocide. And unfortunately, people are not applying the term always correctly because they're saying, okay, there's a destruction of a university. This is epistemic genocide. No, epistemic genocide is way worse than that. Epistemic genocide is the complete elimination of a way of viewing the world, the complete elimination of a way of knowing things, right? So if you want to talk about the indigenous of the United States or the First Nations people in Canada, right? Different types of medicines and the knowledge of herbs and the knowledge of plants and the knowledge of you know, stars and the knowledge of navigation, the knowledge of what land is good for it, and all these different things, that there's a way of dominating and conquering people from the inside, shaping their own subjectivities to eliminate all of this knowledge and this way of knowing. So that for Halakh, that's what Sa'id misses. Sa'id is fuzzy on colonialism and what it is and where it starts and where it ends. That because Sa'id is fuzzy on it, he paints it as all the same, basically. And therefore, if colonialism is just the domination of people, right, in our sort of classical sense, then that's everybody. Right? The Chinese, right? And you hear this from people who are apologists for European colonization, say everybody was doing it. If the Muslims had the technology, they would have done it. If the Chinese had the technology, they would have done it, right? Like, no, not at all. Because it's not simply the early colonization of bodies and resources and land. This is something about eliminating worldviews, eliminating knowledges, shaping people from the inside, kill the Indian, save the man, right? That sort of thing. So, that's the first point. The first point is that the win of colonialism in Sa'id is very fuzzy, which is why actually Sa'id doesn't really, he doesn't centrally feature colonialism. I'll get to a quote later where he says that basically that colonialism helped Orientalism, right? Rather than, that's a very, very light sort of, you know, genteel way of saying, things. It shows that there's a sort of fuzziness when it comes to Sa'id's theorization of what colonialism is and what's the work that it actually does, which essentially, and we'll talk about this more in a bit, that for Sa'id, what is the bad thing about Orientalism is its misrepresentation. So Orientalism as misrepresentation. This is very, very light. This is very, very surface level. And this is, I guess, if you want to come away with anything in this talk, Sa'id understands Orientalism to be fundamentally about misrepresentation, which just scratches the surface to what Orientalism is about. It doesn't even get to half of what Orientalism is about. And Halakh takes issue with that. So because Sa'id only views or primarily views Orientalism as misrepresentation, he sees it everywhere. He sees it back at the Greeks. He sees it back, you know, like before modern violence, before modern colonialism, before liberal colonialism, because simple misrepresentation is something that all people have always engaged in. Even if you go to Islamic travelogues, even Batuta and these sorts of things, they travel the earth, they talk about cultures, they even say these guys are savages, these guys are barbarians. And to Sa'id, that's Orientalism, because it's simply an act of misrepresentation, and thus it's ubiquitous and it's essentialist. So that's the first issue. The first issue that Halakh takes with Sa'id is what's the when? When is colonialism? And Sa'id basically blows it out of proportion and makes it into this infinite thing. Any representation of the East or of the Orient ever is basically Orientalism. So we're talking the Greeks, we're talking the Persians, we're talking anybody. The second question that Saeed asks is, what's the where? Where is colonialism? Where does it exist? And what he's getting at is that, what's our idea or conceptualization of the actors that are at play here? Saeed relies on a very, very black and white notion of East versus West, right? And so the misrepresentation that's going on here, who's perpetuating it, who's guilty, and who's innocent, who's the victim of the crime? For him, it's the West versus the Orient, or the West versus the East, which is why, and this is sort of ironic, he lumps the Greece, ancient Greece, in with the West, though that's something that I think is very contested and should be contested. That does ancient Greece, of course, it was conscripted into the memory of what the West is to sort of like paint some sort of mythological history of democracy and things like that, even though Greek democracy is very, very different from the democracy that we have today. But does it really belong to the West as we understand the West as sort of hegemonic cultural values? Or as I had a professor, Andrew Davison at Vassar College, used to say, we accept democracy, but do we accept the oracles? Do we accept the Greek gods? Is that considered part of the West as well? Not really, right? What is the West is really something that's more specific than this endless geographical sort of arena that happens to conform to the modern boundaries of Europe. So we see that there's some fuzziness based in his ideological assumptions. And this imprecision, right, Halak says, it masks the structures that are responsible for the phenomena that he sees and experiences.
Because at that point, just an aside really about...
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
About the West, I mean, we often think of Rome and the Roman Empire as a Western institution, but right. In terms of its geographical extent, I mean, Rome included North Africa, what we call North Africa. It include Egypt, include Judea, include Mesopotamia, Armenia, you know, what we today call Turkey and so on. In other words, the West, if you like, well, it wasn't the West at all. It included a landmass and a geographic extent that went to what we would call the Middle East. And so that just shows that the definitions of us and them, the West versus the rest, have evolved and changed quite dramatically. And indeed, the Roman Empire, which is seen as a Western institution, actually included a lot of what's called the Middle East now. And that was part of our civilization. So these things are highly contested, and there are assumptions packed into them about what it means to be us as opposed to them. But the Roman Empire shows that it was quite a different world. And, you know, you could be dark skinned, light skinned or whatever, and be part of the Roman Empire equally. There was no sense of they were outside of the empire. They were very much within the empire in many cases.
Yes, they're very ideological deployments, right? Yeah. To deploy the concept of the West, and to imagine that it includes ancient Greece or ancient Rome is a very ideological statement, because what's really happening is that, you know, if the West, first of all, it's not really geographical, because people wouldn't consider Bosnia part of that West usually, right? Muslim Bosnia, or even some of the Eastern European nations, right? Mm. What people mean when they refer to the West is really a set of values, right? Mm. So what happens is that in order to narrate the story of those values and why those values are superior, they go into the past and they conscript different examples that supposedly are the forefathers and forebears of those ideas, right? So why, for example, exactly, why is ancient Rome part of the quote-unquote ideological West, but Carthage is not, right? You know, or any of the other sort of the Phoenician Empire, different things like this. Yeah. These are ideological sort of deployments, right? In reality, much like how modern democracy and Lockean sort of representationalism relies on this myth of social contract to justify the violence of the state. And the example I always give to demonstrate the ridiculousness of that is, if nobody voted in the next election, would the government pack up and go home and say, oh, our social contract's up, I guess we're done? No, they wouldn't. This is a myth that was made up to justify the violence of the nation state. right? So similarly, right, you have to justify the violence of the modern West. You know, what does it stand for? What is it good for? Europe has this discourse, so does the United States, freedom and democracy and et cetera, et cetera. We're at the fore, we're doing good. We're a force of good in world history. Okay, then you need forefathers, you need heroes, you need an enemy to militate against, you need a threat to, you know, to define yourself against, all these sorts of things. But if we go into the weeds and into the details, you know, ancient Greece and ancient Rome has nothing to do with the modern West at all. They're not modern. They're not liberal, that's for sure. They're not, they're barely democratic, you know, in the sense that we understand it, right? So anyway, this is a digression, but these things are ideological. So there's two things. So Halak says that the imprecision, both of time and place, geography and scope of Sa'id's Orientalism, it masks the structures that are responsible for the phenomena that he senses and he wants to critique in the first place. And he traces this back to two particular areas of insufficient theorization within Sa'id. One has to do with the author, the idea of the author. And we'll get to that a lot today, where the idea of who is an author, who is a person that speaks, how does somebody intervene in a discourse? What are they doing when you and I write a book, or you know, you're at Cambridge or at Oxford, or I'm here, or whatever, and we have an act, right? That how does that act fit within a larger discourse, right? Do we have the ability to say anything at all? Are we beholden to either the material, political, ideological sort of interests that shape us? Do we have the ability to rebel and revolt against them? Right? This is what's all understood as the issue of the author. And Foucault talks a lot about this. And so this is actually a big misreading of Foucault that Sa'id goes through. But, you know, Halak unpacks it very well. We'll get there. And then the second thing that Sa'id insufficiently theorized was representation itself. Okay? That he, again, understands Orientalism to primarily be about misrepresentation. But even the idea of what is happening with representation is insufficiently theorized. And so it actually masks these structures that are responsible for what results in what he's writing about in Orientalism and in culture and imperialism. So can the author, let's start with the author. Can the author make what's called a quote unquote, a determining imprint? And this comes from Foucault. Okay. Now the irony is that Sa'id misunderstands Foucault and Foucault is often misunderstood. So again, it's the issue that I just mentioned. What's the relationship between an author and their own ideological constitution and the situation or situatedness in which they write? Does an author have the ability to really revolt against the currents of ideology and interest and grant funding and everything or not? Okay. Sa'id says, he says, yes, he does. But in practice, Sa'id actually says no. Right, so there's an irony. He says, like the literal words in Orientalism and in culture imperialism, he says yes. But if you see play out the actual theorization, the examples, and the logic of Sa'id, he really means no, that you can't. And this is his idea of what Orientalism is: that if you are constituted by the West, you cannot say anything about the Orient. If you do, you're practicing Orientalism. And again, we'll go into detail on that. Ironically. First of all, there's an irony there because he doesn't practice that on himself, because he is somebody, even though he's Palestinian, he's very much constituted by secular humanism, by liberalism. He admittedly, you know, starry-eyed wrote about the cultural and artistic achievements of the West and things like that. And so he doesn't have any place that he reckons with his own sort of complicity within that logic. Put that to the side for a second. Foucault, ironically, in his works, he says no to this question. Can an author make a determining imprint? Can he rise above and revolt? Foucault says no, but he really means yes. So he has a very famous quote that's blown out of proportion by a lot of people who read Foucault, where he says that the author is dead and things like that. And so people took that to mean that that Foucault is saying that an author cannot make a determining imprint, that the author is strictly bound by their ideological constitution and the sort of stream that they're sort of swimming along with, and he can't really But if you look at the whole of Foucault's work in theorization, he obviously means that yes, he can. And we'll get to that. And there's a later chapter in which he specifically talks about the author and the different types of authors. But this is really, really interesting because you've got Saïd misreading Foucault and Foucault being misread by a lot of people, and the both of them meaning the opposite of what they seem to be actually saying. Now, Halak introduces sort of a different sort of way of theorizing this, to understand this, to make it a little bit, to give it more nuance and to give it more detail. So he says that structures, okay, are governed by paradigms, and paradigms can be divided into both central and peripheral domains. Where we're going with this, we're saying, what is the relationship between an author, an individual author, and the times and currents in which they live? How much can they bring something truly new? How much can they revolt and rebel and transcend the sort of conversations that are already going on? Halak introduces this way, this map or this schematic, in order to illustrate his point about what room you have to revolt and what room maybe you don't have to revolt. So he says that there are structures, okay, in society, and those structures are governed by paradigms. And paradigms are divided into both central and peripheral domains. Okay, now this helps us answer a couple questions. How are different domains related to each other? How do discourses change over time? How do we account for the rise of new ideologies? How do we account for the Marxes and the Freuds of the world, who really did seem to bring something at least relatively new, if not quite new, right? So Halak introduces this idea of paradigms, central and peripheral domains, to account for this, and the situation in which, or the context in which they're writing, okay? So it gets us to pay attention to how are authors positioned within these paradigms? Are they operating in the central domain, meaning are they just talking heads for power? Are they operating within a peripheral domain, which is sort of pushing against that central domain? Does a peripheral domain eventually get enough steam or momentum to become a central domain, right? These are things that basically he goes on to theorize. So to give some examples, okay, and to clearly sort of indicate what's the difference. Okay, this sounds interesting, but what's the difference between a central domain and a peripheral domain? He says, a central domain is hegemonic in such a way that the problems of other domains, meaning peripheral domains, are solved in the terms of the central domain. And it shapes the priorities, the central domain shapes the priorities of all the other sort of domains. Example. We live in a time in which technology is a paradigm. Okay, technology is considered a central domain. People think about how to solve environmentalism, food scarcity. They think how to solve poverty. They think how to solve lots of issues in terms of technological advancement. Okay, that is hegemonic. What's much like Elon Musk thinking he's going to blast a bunch of satellites into space and save the world with Starlink or whatever it is, that demonstrates the hegemony of technological progress as a central domain. A much more peripheral domain is a critique of that technological advancement, the Luddites of the world, the people who are trying to go back to the earth and, you know, save seeds and weave their own clothes. This is not hegemonic at all, right? So this is an example where if you say, okay, we have an issue in our era, we have pollution. How are we gonna solve pollution? I know, let's invent some sort of contraption that's going to suck up the pollution and convert it to something else, like they've done with the plastics in the ocean and otherwise, right? Or we're gonna invent an electric car that instead of running on gasoline, because gasoline is fossil fuels, and fossil fuels, you burn them and it heats up the Earth's atmosphere and global warming. Instead, we're going to have electric cars and et cetera. This is a technological solution. So it shapes the priorities of all the other domains, and it becomes the language within which the other domains are almost forced to operate. Why do we care about scientific miracles in the Quran? because science and scientific knowledge is hegemonic. It's the central domain of the times in which we live. If we lived in another era, we wouldn't care about scientific miracles in the Quran. It wouldn't be relevant. It wouldn't be seen as a dawah tool, right? But now you've got everybody saying, oh, look, this and that and the third, and the Quran already said this, and this is like just, right? Mm. It's meaningful. It takes on meaning because it is the central domain or one of many central domains. So this is sort of an illustration of what it is that he's talking about.
Also, just slightly tangential, there's a certain modern translation, I won't mention what it is, which in some of its comments at the bottom is a highly popular translation, talks about the Quran endorsing or propounding human rights, actually uses the expression right. human rights. I'm thinking human rights, the Quran. I mean, this is very controversial, and I don't mean by that that the Quran doesn't respect the dignity of the person, but is this using the language of secular liberalism and seeing it somehow emanating from the Quran or compatible with the Quran? There's a very striking discourse that, to my mind, sits quite uneasily with that. Really,
yeah, 100%. We can say that in some sense, in a very, very so general to be useless sense, the Quran supports human rights, but. The human is different. The human of the Quran is different from the human that's implicit in human rights. People always focus on the rights part and they forget about what human we're talking about without realizing that your definition of human determines your conception of what rights you're entitled to. Okay. If you believe that you have a soul and an afterlife, that completely alters the sense of rights that you're entitled to compared to someone who thinks that there is no soul and there is no afterlife.
And the question of ownership as well, of course, according to the Quran, God owns everything on the heavens and the earth. Therefore, we are owned by God, whether or not we acknowledge his existence. And so we're not these morally autonomous beings who have complete control over our bodies. My body, my right language. So the anthropology that's assumed into this term human is vital to unpack that. Otherwise, we end up just slipping into the paradigm again.
Yes, 100%. And that's a nice demonstration of central domains and the hegemony of certain paradigms that we feel like we have to say that Islam supports human rights, or Islam is feminist, or Islam is this, or Islam means peace, right? These are all demonstrations of the hegemony of certain ideologies and the central domains in which they dominate, to be frank, and the peripheral domain in which a truly Islamic discourse currently resides, okay? Now, the nice thing about the central domain, peripheral domain, is that it's not a death sentence. And we'll get there in a second, because that's actually an extremely crucial point that Sa'id fails to take into account. So, okay, that gives enough a good enough sense, I think. I have some other examples, but that gives a good enough sense of what he's talking about when he talks about central and peripheral domains and paradigms. So the Enlightenment is another paradigm, right? Which he has an awesome definition for in this book, and I'll just state it for our own benefit. He says the Enlightenment is the displacement of local and traditional moralities and transcendental faith by rational morality and a universal civilization, which can both accommodate liberalism and Marxism. Okay, so that's another thing. So you ask, you know, some people, and this is relevant to Palestinian activism, because a lot of people, you know, they're pro-Palestinian, but they're from the Marxist persuasion. And so they're all about sort of the class revolution and, you know, want to see things just from a materialist perspective. Well, there are ways in which you have to understand what is Marxism or Marxist discourse within the entire paradigm in which we sit. Is it truly something that is challenging the foundation of the hegemonic paradigm that is operating? And the answer is no, it's not. Actually, Marxism and liberalism are two sides of the same coin of the Enlightenment paradigm, right? That Marxism is an Enlightenment ideology.
This is such an important point. It's something that I first came across when I was shocked by it, actually. It's precisely what you said in the works of Julius Evola, the Italian philosopher, who sees all of these post-Enlightenment philosophies as very much organically connected. They're part of the same family. So socialism, liberalism, democracy, communism, Marxism actually all have the same kind of anthropocentric, man-centered, liberal assumptions. So they're actually very, very similar. Some take it further down the path than others, but the way they are understood in the Western paradigm often seems opposite. So, you know, democracy and communism opposites, or liberalism and so on. But actually, they're not philosophically. They both had their roots in the Renaissance and the Enlightenment as well. It's such an important insight, that, because one really helps to get get to grasp at a very deep level the philosophical assumptions of these worldviews and how similar they are actually, that or even the same actually, arguably.
Yeah, no, that, it is a huge point and a point that's lost on, I think, a lot of non-Muslims. For Muslims, it's more intuitive that these things are closer than if you talk to a non-Muslim, they think that these things are very radically apart. Yeah. Marxism is essentially a reform movement of liberal capitalism. Right? Yeah. It's nothing more. It's not anything that's really philosophically radical, as you indicated. Yeah. But anyway, so when we understand how this is the lay of the land with domains, okay, you have a paradigm that's hegemonic, you have a central domain, and you have peripheral domains. Now you can study the relationships both within those domains and in between those domains, and you can see how you can develop a theory of change. And Halak and Foucault, well, he points to Foucault, and Foucault calls this force relations. How do they relate to each other? How is change possible within this scheme of these different domains and how they sort of operate? To understand how change is possible, we need to understand one sort of concept that basically kind of destroys Said's Orientalism, which is performativity. Now, performativity became famous throughout feminist discourse and Judith Butler because she said gender is performative. Most people don't understand what this word means unless you have a philosophy degree. Performative is not the same as performance, and a lot of people conflate the two. Just like normal is not the same as normative, right? So many people, they think, oh, gender is performative. It just means that we're performing gender. That's not what Judith Butler says. That's not what she means. That's not what people mean when they say performative. They almost mean something closer to the idea of Greek habitus, that when you choose to act in the world, it creates a possibility for a different reality for the next action. Okay? So these things are not just expressive. They're not just representational, which is why it goes against Said's Orientalism, because Said's Orientalism is just representational. No, they actually structure reality. Your actions structure reality. So everything that you do and everything that you choose to do, which was Butler's argument about gender, right, that it actually re-entrenches or is the site of subverting the reality. Okay, so every single act, every single, even a speech act, even a textual act, is you're either re-entrenching something or you're pushing against it and undermining it or subverting it. Okay, so this exists with discourses, and this exists with these sort of domains, that each of these domains, they have discourses. The central domain of, if we want to say capitalism, or we want to say enlightenment, or we want to say technological progress or whatever, every single article that comes out in the New York Times, in, you know, the BBC or whatever, is a certain speech act that either further entrenches this paradigm or tries to chip away at it a little bit. That's the idea of performativity. And when you understand that, you see the opportunities for change and you see how change can actually happen. That there are, even within a certain central domain or a hegemonic sort of paradigm, there's the ability to tolerate multiple discourses. Let's look at what's going on in Palestine right now.
I just wanted to follow up on your thoughts about Judith Butler, because, you know, she's also, as you say, but very well known for this, her theory of gender performativity. But it's funny, I actually saw her a month or two ago on YouTube. It might have been actually been even on TikTok, actually talking about the Palestinians, actually. And everything she said was like so correct. You know, she had a profound understanding. She was able to really deconstruct the American Zionist narrative. And that paradigm, that whole narrative that she was articulating, very compatible with what you might believe or I might believe. But on the other hand, she's also, you know, in another discourse, in another reality, she's, you know, she comes up with this gender performativity, gender as a social construct, and so on. So you get this, and she's obviously very supportive of LGBT rights and so forth. So these different paradigms, discourses operating simultaneously, some compatible with and some not, and that's rather makes it more complicated in one's relationship with Judith Butler, who, by the way, is, if people didn't know, she's a leading professor at she's in California, I think, I forget which university she's at, but she's written amazing.
And if someone wants a very astute and succinct critique of Judith Butler, in addition to just a great book all around, Politics of Piety by Sabah Mahmood, the late Pakistani anthropologist. Wow. That book is fantastic. I went back to reading it for an article I'm working on for Yakin Institute, and I hadn't read it in 12 years. And wow, subhanAllah, like what a book. Now, Sabah Mahmood points out about Butler is that Butler senses something but fails to actually apply it consistently. And it ends up causing her theoretical trouble. In the sense that Butler senses something that Esad pointed out, Talal Esad, in the potential value and virtue of things unchosen, things suffered, right? Which is a much more sort of pre-modern way of looking at things. However, she couldn't actually escape her valuation, perhaps because of her ideological sort of orientation or whatever, of subverting all norms, right? So this is where, like, people wonder all the time, like people talk postmodernism, oh my God, it's so bad. Postmodernism, you know, okay, it can be a useful tool. Deconstruction, when we're talking about postmodernism, we're talking about deconstruction. Deconstruction can be a very, very useful tool. But like all tools, you need to know what it's used for and what it's not used for. If I take a screwdriver and I try to bang in a nail, I'm going to hurt myself. Right? Like, it has to be used for a proper thing. Deconstruction and postmodernism in general gets into trouble when it attempts to stray into the idea of, like, constructing. Obviously, it can't construct anything. It's deconstruction, right? Or when we apply it in a nihilistic way, which many have done, right? In the sense that nothing is sacred, we can't believe in anything, etc., etc. This is not the only way to relate to the tools that postmodernism and deconstruction sort of provide. Deconstruction provides really significant tools because you have to realize historically, deconstruction and postmodernism is reacting to modernism and enlightenment, you know, sort of philosophy. So if you're looking to undermine and demolish enlightenment philosophy, there's nothing stronger than deconstruction and postmodernism, right? All the self-evident truths that the Lockes and the John Stuart Mills of the world sort of propounded, right, completely takes the wind out of their sails, completely demolishes it. Now, that doesn't mean that that tool is then useful for every sort of thing. Just because some things are social constructs doesn't mean that everything's a social construct. Or just because, even let's say, for just for the sake of argument, that everything is a social construct doesn't mean that that's bad. If we introduce the divine element, right, then we see that there are actual some constructs that are good, right, and that there are things that there is truth, and there are things that are worth believing in and worth dying for, etc.
The point I know it's a trite point to make, but I feel I want to make it anyway. The idea that all truth is relative is so the idea that the postmodernism relativizes everything, that also relativizes the very claim that all truth is relative. It's the statement that all truth is relative is actually self-refuting, because it means that statement itself is not an absolute, you know, it's just culturally relative. I mean, because it's kind of an acid that eats away metaphysically at everything, and leads you with basically a black hole. And that I think would be the ultimate defeater of this worldview, that it leads mankind with nothing, kind of a black hole of a void. Nihilism, this is something that Nietzsche anticipated this and spoke powerfully to this 100 years ago. He died, literally 124 years ago. So it is something that's vacuous at the end of the day, because it doesn't have any foundations. But anyway, that's my lay response.
No, definitely. And, you know, this is actually an interesting segue to something that Halak points out, that there's a difference sometimes between the initial authorial act, a Foucault or a Butler, and then where their ideas are taken, right? We have neo-Marxism, right? Did Marxism end with Marx? No, it didn't, right? Like, Marxism continued to be theorized. Then you got Gramsci. Then you got all these other people, right? And then it takes on a life of its own. Well, the same thing with Foucault, the same thing with postmodernism, the same thing with, you know, with Butler and these different thinkers. When they introduce an idea into a space, right, it has an initial sort of intent and act, and then it also takes on a life of its own, where then it gets understood in a certain way, it gets applied to different scenarios, right? This is actually a crucial point to understanding the weakness of Sa'id's idea of Orientalism and the strength of Halak's when it understands, again, what's the theory of change here? Okay, let's see. Sa'id's understanding of Orientalism is extremely thin and doesn't allow for any change. Okay, so if Orientalism is simply about misrepresentation, if it is ubiquitous, anytime the West tries to talk about the East, anytime the West tries to talk about the Orient, right, then we have something of a conspiracy afoot, don't we? Right? It's something that resembles the thinness of a conspiracy theory. Why do people roll their eyes when someone gets into their conspiracy theory? Because it assumes a hyper internal rationality, right? And a sort of consistency in power that is so totalizing that it seems like you can't escape it, right? Things, if that's how history works, then things seem to pop up very mysteriously. Where did this thing come from? How did Sa'id come to talk about this stuff? Why isn't he just, subject to his own critique? And then it also, for the future, kills history. It basically is an end of history sort of perspective where there is no possibility for change in the future. Is there any possibility that the West will end or that the West will change? Or was there a time before the West? Or is there a possibility of a world in which the West does not dominate the Orient? Or these sorts of things. According to this, to Sa'id, sort of very essentialist, very sort of, we'll say fuzzy, like imprecise idea of what Orientalism is and how it works, there's no beginning to history and there's no end. There's no way for accounting for how Orientalism, what he senses, actually came about historically, what are the ideological forces that led to it, and there's no way out. It's just we have this thing here, and this is why it's led to this sort of identitarian politics, where, again, if we're talking about authors who have introduced an idea and then other people have taken it, where we get now the sort of what in feminist theory is called standpoint theory, where it's like you're a white male and I'm, you're a straight white male. Well, you can't say anything about race, or you can't say anything about etc. because that's not your that's not the identity that you represent. Sa'id set up that possibility where that became a very, very entrenched discourse because, according to Sa'id, you and I, Paul, should not be Muslims. Right?
Yeah.
Essentially, you and I are just in this process of exotification of the East, exoticization of Islam. Maybe we're, you can read the book Desiring Arabs and these sorts of things, and we've got some sort of Freudian complex in ourselves. We're not well in the head. We're not right. That's Sa'id's conception of Orientalism, okay? Obviously, it doesn't account for reality. There's something else going on deeper than that. There are you and me and the Guy Eatons and the René Guénons of the world, right? And actually, Halak goes on to talk explicitly.
He uses the population of Bosnia and other places in Eastern Europe, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we have an insufficient theory of change, a very unworkable theory of change, if Sa'id is correct about Orientalism and how it works. In reality, every single discourse has the potential to be resisted by certain strategies or subverted by other discourses, both within the central domain and between domains. So let's take something that's central right now, which is Zionism. Zionism is a central domain, okay? And we see that, applied to the world right now. There's a bunch of different forces that amalgamate to make what's going on in Palestine possible. Not all the discourses that are responsible and that feed into that amalgamation are consistent with each other. There are some that are at odds with another. There are even certain discourses, such as, like, take American exceptionalism, that can be wielded in a way that undermines that central domain, right? If you look at the Tucker Carlsons and the Candace Owens, right, of the world, who are America First sort of Republicans that are saying, why are we putting our money towards all these foreign, I think Candace Owens said, like, why are we helping Israel patrol their border and we don't have enough money to patrol ours, You can disagree with the argument because you don't like that statement, but you see how even a certain discourse that you would suspect would be in line with a certain power and a certain policy can actually be wielded to undermine, right? The central domain and the discourse that's sort of hegemonic. That's Halak's point, is that both within central domains, you have the potential, because even the Enlightenment, and you know this better than I do, even the Enlightenment had different counter narratives. He cites Kierkegaard as an example of somebody who was somebody like the existentialists, like not really completely in lockstep with the rest of Enlightenment philosophy. Mm-hmm. It was sort of a subversive rivulet or tributary within sort of the Enlightenment thrust. Yes, the Enlightenment thrust has a thrust. It's not like we're saying you can't say anything about the Enlightenment because it's complex and hybridity and this nonsense.
No, it would be that his, without going into Kierkegaard's existentialism, so-called, but it's very much individualist, the sense of the individual expressing his angst and his suffering in relationship to God. The point being that fits snugly within the Enlightenment worldview because individualism is a part of it. So even though his theology, he's very, very, very theocentric, nevertheless, the expression of that is existentialist worldview fits snugly within that. It doesn't challenge it. I mean, with any fundamental level, really. So it is an offshoot from that. I think you're right. Yeah.
Yes. And so when you start to pay attention to the nuance of the ideological landscape, you can actually start to see the opportunities for change and for undermining what is currently hegemonic. Like he brings up, for example, let's imagine what was hegemonic before Enlightenment. What was hegemonic before liberalism? The church and the monarchy. Okay, there were discourses within the church that supported secularism. Now, people misinterpret this. They say, oh, look, so it's not really secularism. It's not really this or whatever. That's not the point. The point is that sometimes discourses align almost like electrons between atoms, where they align up in interesting ways that you wouldn't necessarily suspect, where there's a dominant, a central domain, but there's a sub-discourse within that central domain that actually aligns with an insurgent peripheral domain that is going to try to unseat the one that's currently central. Now we're moving and we have a theory or at least a conceptualization of how change can occur, right? So there is under Halak's sort of scheme, and this is something that, you know, I think Foucault does take into account, even though he says what he says about the dead author, that this is how things can ascend. Okay, you can have peripheral discourses that become central. They can unseat and overthrow central domains, right? This is something that happens. So when it comes to the author, Said misunderstands Foucault. Authors are actually the engines of what Foucault calls discursivity, right? So like being part of a discourse, that performative sort of element where every single speech act, you are creating reality. You are either creating the possibility for something to happen or you're closing down the possibility for something to happen. And so these are little micro moments of opportunity where discourses jockey. Discourses and domains jockey for position and try to unseat one another. So let's see, we talked about that already. We jumped ahead a little bit. So this allows for a theory of change. You've got authors, you've got founders, you've got the difference between the initiation of a discourse, right? The Marx, and then the transformation of a discourse where it becomes a reference point, right? Marxism after Marx. You've got things that become individual that eventually end up being canonized, singularity that becomes discursivity. Anyway, the point is that this entire scheme allows for change, whereas Said's conception of history is very thin and doesn't really allow for change.
I think just sort of a bird's eye view here, that the one thing that strikes me as characteristic of the West is precisely that word change, that we go through multiple paradigm shifts as the West thrashes around trying to find a centeredness, a stability, a foundation upon which to base the social order. We've had the, as you say, the crown and the church that didn't work out for various reasons. Then we've had this kind of Enlightenment model with people like Locke, but also we've had reactions against that in fascism. Giovanni Gentile, the Italian philosopher in the 40s, articulating a very anti-modern, anti-liberal, anti-Enlightenment philosophy. Again, another shift And that was very popular in many countries in Europe. And then it shifted back again after World War II to a kind of a liberal secular paradigm with the dominance of the US globally. And the West is always thrashing around like a fevered patient, trying to find rest, trying to find peace within itself, within a worldview which eludes itself. And so, you know, Judith Butler is yet another kind of attempt to deconstruct and maybe create a new world. And compare that to the deep peace of Islam, where what one simply exists in one's relationship with the divine, with God, and where one's preoccupation is with simple justice and those things that connect us with the divine. And that is a much more tranquil and metaphysically secure foundation for a social order than this fevered thrashing around, trying to find what does it mean to be European, what does it mean to be American or Western, and it's all and generating wars and conflicts and endless heartache over the generations. And we've seen two world wars over these things. And maybe that is a characteristic of the West, this obsession with change. It's just kind of changing things all the time and finding that elusive peace, which cannot come through this constant preoccupation with change. It must transcend that into the divine. And that's when Islam, of course, comes in and says, yeah, your peace lies with your creator, not with this fevered obsession with trying to find peace in the dunya. The dunya will not give you that.
Yes. No, I think that's something explored very well by Seba Mahmoud in Politics of Piety, that the understanding of autonomy that is at the root of Enlightenment philosophy and thus the modern West is one that measures your agency and your ability to resist and rebel against all unchosen norms. Mm-hmm. And that is by just foundationally a very agitated state to be in. I think agitation.
Agitation. I like that. Yeah. Yeah. Or I call it the kind of feveredness, the sense of being unwell, or the agitation. One's never at rest. And Islam, in the very word, has the salam, has the sense of peace within that, which is simply not there in the DNA of the ideology in the West.
Yes. And what the fascinating thing for me is that the West, as you said, feverishly sort of thrashing about, swinging back and forth between sort of extremes and overreacting. I think this is a huge thing. And overgeneral
swinging backwards and forwards, and we're going through now another swing back against so-called multiculturalism in the West to a different conception. And there is no what kind of peace is there? What are we offering the world with that kind of ideology?
Exactly, because the idea that I think that for the modern West, the idea of endless change and autonomy and self-making and this sort of thing is a reaction against what was basically oppressive man-made norms that were imposed previously. Now, the conclusion and the interpretation that was drawn from that was that all norms that are not chosen are oppressive, when in reality, the submission to divine norms is the only place that you'll find peace.
Yeah.
So there's been almost like an overgeneral reaction where it's like, oh, we've got all these norms that are forced upon us. Rebel against all norms, make your own life, make your own self. That's where peace will lie. No. You've just submitted to the wrong norms. Once you submit the differences, divine norms versus man-made norms, and you'll never find any peace in the man-made norms because they're epistemically limited, right? They're going to fall afoul. They're going to miss things. Okay, so before we transition, this is pretty much the first part of our presentation today. We'll cap it off with critique. Okay, so Halak centers in on the idea of critique as demonstrating.
Yeah, and hence the title of the book, of course, A Critique of Modern Knowledge. Just I'll mention the book again. For those who don't have it, do get it. It's a rewarding, if challenging, read. Mm-hmm.
So the idea of critique in and of itself belies Said's idea of history and the way that ideologies come about or change or not, as the case may be. That critique is the right to call truth into question. And the idea of critique implies that the author has an imprint. It implies that the author is able to speak out and redirect course, right? Without that sort of ability, then critique would not mean anything. And so he says that critique, and he quotes from Kant here, and then he furthers it, is the ability to refuse what we are and build up what we could be. And so this is the refuse what we are is Kant. And then he also says, build up what we could be. That this is, and that's sort of like Foucault, the whole idea of, you know, technologies of the self and things like that, that this fact that this exists demolishes Said's theorization of what Orientalism is and how it works, or at least the scope of it. Now, we're going to get into some more detail here about Said's own. We're going to recreate Said's argument of Orientalism, and we'll see how Halak sort of takes it down point by point. And that'll be it for today. That's it for chapter one. But that's the last thing when he's sort of treating this thing from a bird's eye view, that if Said's account of Orientalism and the way that history moves was correct, then critique would not be possible, right? Critique within a central domain, critique between peripheral and central domains, critique within the West, critique between, from different movements. Again, we would have this things appearing historically, seemingly out of nowhere, mysteriously, and then sort of an end of history where there's no change in sight. And obviously we know that that's not true. So when it comes to Said's actual sort of argument of what is Orientalism, Halak presents four key structures. The first is distance. The second is difference. The third is power. And the fourth is text. That essential to Said's definition of Orientalism is that the distance between the West and East, or the West and the Orient, creates an assumption or a reality of difference. And that difference is the site of power, and that power is acted out in texts. That's essentially, again, like 30,000 feet above, that's what it is. What we mean by distance, again, that this distance is both epistemic and ontological. So there's a fundamental inability for the West to understand the East, for the West to understand the Orient. And ontological meaning that the West and the Orient are sensible things, right? Are actual sort of like discernible things, which should strike one as odd, because what is the West really? As we've said, does it include ancient Greece? Does it include modern Bosnia? Does it include the Magyars? Does it include even Eastern Europe, right? These things are actually quite contested. Said takes them as bald fact at face value and says that there is an epistemic and ontological distance between West and the Orient, and it can't be bridged, right? That the Orient is characterized by silence. It cannot speak. And anybody who's familiar with postcolonial theory knows that this was a classic question. Can the subaltern speak, right? This comes from Said, that the Orient is silent. It does not have the ability to speak back to the West, that the West produces knowledge about the Orient. And then this has become sort of a canonical hostility of the West towards the East in this distance.
And if I could just say, I mean, this is something I've heard people mention recently. I've seen it both in the British media and in American media, is the absence of Palestinian voices to do with the current genocide in Gaza. And I'm struck when I read leading media outlets like The Times and The Telegraph in the UK, let alone The Daily Mail, where in their endless fulminations against Palestinians for being extreme and et cetera, you rarely, in fact, you never hear a Palestinian voice actually speaking to this at all. It's always from the other paradigm, the Zionist paradigm. And yes. I hear in America, it's the same with the media. How often does one hear, Jewish voices, Zionist voices all the time, whether it be in the Senate or Congress or wherever? When do you hear a Palestinian voice, a Palestinian woman, a Palestinian ever speaking? And this absence of the Orient in the Western Orientalist discourse is continuing, even in our current media age, which apparently can survey anything and suck up anything and talk about anything. These voices are simply missing. And yeah. So we get a very, the dominant paradigm still dominates, but in a way that which I thought would be impossible. It's total. It's almost 100%, you know. You really have to look carefully in other social media outlets to find different voices, but they're not going to the mainstream ones, unfortunately.
No, that's true. And that's the appeal of Said's Orientalism and sort of the identitarian politics that it kind of causes, is that it does describe an aspect of reality. But the mistake in Said's sort of conceptualization is how totalizing this distance and difference is, to the point where it fails to account for, let's say, tokenization. So let's say BBC finds a Palestinian that happens to agree with Zionism. We'll find a Palestinian Zionist. Okay. According to Saeed's sort of analysis, that shouldn't necessarily be possible. Now, just like that shouldn't be possible, also, we do find that there's Norman Finkelsteins, right? There's people who are solidly from the West who totally get it and totally understand. That's not to say, and he knows his own limitations, when, you know, I'm not saying that he's speaking for Palestinians, but there are Palestinians who are constituted by other ideological forces to the point, and they're used, they're tokenized, right? To the point where Norm Finkelstein is better than some of them on Palestine, right? That's a fact, okay? So it's not that Saeed's theory of Orientalism doesn't get at what is observable in our reality. It's that it's a caricature. And it doesn't get to the real nitty-gritty of what's going on, right? And he says, you know, Halak says, we say in English, right, familiarity breeds contempt, right? That the assumption that distance necessarily carries with it this sort of contempt is not a foregone conclusion. There's some ways in which distance can be reverential, and there's also ways in which distance can be, problematic. There's ways in which proximity can be reverential, and there's ways in which proximity can also be problematic. So things just aren't so theoretically clean and black and white as Saeed portrays them. So the assumption then is that because there's distance, both epistemic distance and ontological distance between East and West, then that leads to the understanding of difference. And this is something that completely the whole paradigm of identity politics and the modern progressive left is built on, this idea, otherization, right? Like the other, right? This is where Saeed is talking about that you can't essentially say anything. If you're in the West, you have no right to say anything. You can't say anything meaningful about the Orient or the East. If you say something negative, then this is the demonstration of your bigotry and your animosity and your contempt. If you say something positive, then you're guilty of exotification, right? That you're exoticizing it, you're romanticizing it, right? It's et cetera, et cetera. There's no room for the West or a Westerner to morally or ethically speak about the East in this framework. And this is where we get, again, if you've been on a college campus or university campus, you should understand very intuitively everything that I'm talking about and see how far this logic has been taken, right? Why do college students or university students start their speeches by as a this, that, the other? And they start with their identity, right? As a Palestinian, as a Muslim woman, as a this. Now, someone can look at this and they can say, oh, that's harmless. They're just sort of whatever. Or they can realize that ideologically, this is something that's staking out their epistemic claim to truth, right? That they have a more right to the truth to speak about this particular issue, not because of the content of what they're about to say, not because of the adherence or the internal coherence and validity of what they're saying, but by virtue of their identity, right? Mm-hmm. So you see how, you know, Saeedian sort of Orientalism was
and there's a hierarchy as well of that. So, in some contexts, a Palestinian voice would have very little value at all in some contexts, and other voices would have a much stronger presence by virtue of that very identity, but without any consideration of the argument of the coherence or the facticity of what's been said. I notice the Palestinian or brown non-white people often have come quite low down in this Western hierarchy. I mean,
mm-hmm. Yes. But there are also micro spaces, and this is, I think, important, where that's reversed, where the logic is considered the same. Logic is not challenged, but merely the privileged class and the underprivileged class are switched, right?
Yes.
So if we're talking about true change or true sort of questioning the premises upon which a worldview is based, if we take that technique or that structure and then we just sort of invert it and plug it in differently, we're essentially assuming the same logic as it, right? But just sort of flipping around who's the privileged and who's the not. So distance to difference, difference to power. Now, this is crucial because Said says that Orientalism was, quote unquote, reinforced by colonial power, which is very revealing. It shows that Said understands Orientalism as preceding colonialism, right? And that Orientalism is a much more sort of pervasive force throughout history. And he really kind of doesn't speak a whole lot, like, or he even, I don't want to say downplays, downplays is too strong of a word, but de-emphasizes, I think, de-emphasizes the colonial encounter. He makes the colonial encounter much more about representation and discourse than about either guns and bombs and bodies, or even about domination, these sorts of things. Now, I understand there's an argument to be made there because the discourse can shape the possibility for the subsequent domination and things like that. But it shows something that Halak points out, that Said, he understands things chronologically and not structurally, meaning to say he doesn't realize, and this is the point of Halak's whole book, that this genocidal sort of orientation is actually built into Western knowledge in and of itself. Yeah. It's not simply a matter of misrepresentation, and it's not simply a matter of animus or animosity or bigotry, and it's not simply something that's reinforced by the colonial encounter or by colonial power. That the structure of modern knowledge, it depends upon structural genocide in a way that Said was completely blind to, because Said was, to be frank, he was a secular humanist, right? So
yeah,
there's ways in which, because Said was a secular humanist, he was blind to the ways in which secularism itself was tied up with racism and colonialization. That this is not just a mere scholarly blindness by Said, that it's not just a misrepresentation, that this is actually a discursive strategy. This is something that, how does this representation of Said, when he's talking about what is Orientalism, how does it work? It's a discursive strategy. It hides the ways in which secularism is violent. It hides the ways in which secularism is racist. It hides the ways in which modern power actually works, because Said is constituted and speaking from modern power, despite his Palestinianness. Despite his Palestinianness, he's operating and speaking through power when he has disparaging things to say about religious people, right? He is reenacting this power. And though, because he is Palestinian, he senses something that's going on that is power, and he's trying to describe and he's trying to theorize it, but ultimately, he's just beating around the bush. He's not getting to the heart of the matter because of his own ideological constitution. He is, like he theorized, the author that does not have a distinctive imprint, that does not have a determining imprint. He's actually doing quite a bit to re-entrench and re-inscribe the power that he's trying to critique by leaving intact and actually concealing the nature and the anatomy of that power and its violence. The fourth structural element of Said's Orientalism, after distance, difference, power, is the text. And it's significant that Said primarily understands Orientalism as having to do with texts, that Orientalism is textual, it's symbolic, which is why Halak blasts him for skipping over William Jones and the like, as saying that, well, this is just law. William Jones, somebody who came in and completely redefined the juridicality, and Foucault is much more attuned to the juridicality of power, redefined law, like Halak goes into in The Impossible State, redefined the idea of what law was, changing the way, completely wiping out worldviews. Said is blind to that. Said only sees Orientalism as an issue of representation, that the Orient is being misrepresented. And it's not anything to do with this sort of juridicality, the elimination of worldviews, structural genocide, epistemic genocide, these sorts of things.
I mean, if I were to say, this is slightly off point, it's just, it strikes me with the way you're speaking, articulating, well, Halak's position here. And I think for me, the clue to what I'm about to say is in the title, A Critique of Modern Knowledge. It seems to me that, well, Halak, in a way, is doing what Kant did to this idea of pure reason, the idea of Descartes, and obviously to Hume as well. The idea that he advocated as he called it, a Copernican revolution, moving away from this surface level engagement to the deep structures of epistemology, whether it be a priori, a posteriori, creating the synthetic a priori concept. But the way that he, this word critique reminds me of A Critique of Pure Reason, this Kant's magnum opus. And I suspect that's not an accident. He's using this word, a critical engagement with Orientalism, as opposed to this Orientalism of Said before. So he's taking it deep down and looking at the epistemology of the issue, whereas Said wasn't. And it strikes me as a very Kantian move, actually. That it really reminds me of the way Kant dealt with his interlocutors, people like Hume and Descartes. And I wonder if, I'm sure what Halak's aware of that, but it's almost like what Halak is our Kant. There's a certain similarity of moves or the way he's dealing with this. I think that's, I quite like the idea that he's our Kant.
That's a really nice observation. And he told me in our private conversations, he said that the real title is the subtitle. So you really hit on it. Like,
A critique of modern knowledge, or a critique of pure reason, a critique. Yeah. But it's the way he's doing it is very Kantian. He's saying, let's move beyond the superior. Let's go deep down into the epistemology. And that's precisely what Kant did, a critique of CPR, as I call it. You'll need CPR after reading it. It's a joke, you know, have a heart attack. And in a sense, reading Halak, also you'll need CPR after reading Halak, because he's also pretty Kantian in his impenetrability, although he's not as bad as Kant. I'll give him some, if he ever hears, but he's not as bad as Kant, but in terms of his impenetrability, but nevertheless, they are both on that scale, I think. So I think he'll get the award as the Muslim Kant, I think we can call him that.
That's very astute. That's a well observed. So at this point, Halak takes Said to task for never actually telling us what the Orient is. And this is significant. It's not just accidental. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's actually essential for Said's critique to not be completely subverted and fall on its face. That for Said, the Orient has no concrete reality, because Said understands Orientalism as just misrepresentation. Said refuses to represent the Orient, because if he did, then he would be held account for misrepresentation, that he would be subjecting himself to critique, the very critique that he embarked upon. And as somebody who was firmly situated in Western power and firmly acculturated to Western culture and an open admirer of Western values and Western culture, if Said ventured to represent the Orient, he would probably very quickly be exposed as somebody who didn't really have very much to say about the Orient itself in the first place. This, Halak says, creates a tautology. He said that Said's Orientalism is essentially a tautology, that it's modern liberal sensibilities repackaged, that you can't, you know, it insulates Said's Orientalism from critique in an evasive and somewhat dishonest way. Not dishonest in the intentionality of it, but in a sort of, in a shortcoming sort of way, in a blind sort of way. He also points out, so some other critiques that Halak says is that distance is neither distinctive nor particular to Orientalism. Okay? That otherness, right, is not particular to Orientalism, that every culture, by definition, has to have others, right? Even the plurality of cultures, and you can use also religions or worldviews or whatever, necessarily constructs others. That's not sufficient to illustrate and illuminate the violent relationship between the modern West and the rest of the world or the Orient. Distance is not sufficient. Other cultures, other worldviews, other civilizations have had distance and have not enacted the violence that the modern West has enacted. Now, when I was an undergrad, and we talked about this issue a lot, the going theory in post-colonial studies was that it was not just distance. So they've moved on from Said's sort of just pure distance to the idea that it was seeing the other as lack. And that was the sort of language, that it was the valuation of the other as something less than the self that was responsible for the violence. But that also is insufficient because, again, the same things that Halath is pointing out, such as the travelogues of, you know, Middle Eastern or Arab explorers who readily talk about savages and barbarians and this and that and the other, and clearly have a sense of hierarchy that we are better than these people, did not genocide them, right? And so even this evolution within post-colonial theory that the violence is really about seeing the other as less also does not hold water, that there's something else going on, that there is something we have to really drill down on exactly what is responsible for modern Western violence in the world. And it's not distance, and it's not just seeing the other as inferior. It's something more specific. Halak, spoiler alert, is going to say that it's in the structure of knowledge that animates the entire West. And so what Said actually does, right, is that he gives modern violence a pass. He gives modern violence a pass by making it simply about distance, by making it simply about misrepresentation. He fails to actually put his finger on what is truly responsible, because if he did, it would undermine his own secular, liberal, modern values that he was very, very much an advocate
of. I'm going to push back here just a bit. I know what you're saying. I understand what Halak's saying. It's being a bit harsh on poor old Orientalism here, because for many of us, and me included, reading it was akin to having one's consciousness raised. It was a paradigm shifting moment, you know, as a white male living in the West. It was it helped to open up vistas and perspectives that I was previously unaware of. And although the theoretical criticisms that you're articulating may all be valid, and I think they are, nevertheless, in terms of the existential transformation that many people have undergone in the West in reading Said's work, I think it shouldn't be lost, the value of that, in subsequent critical interaction with his work, because it really was a paradigm shifting work for many of us, which is why it's so popular. It's also beautifully written. A work. It's a work of prose in its own right, a work of literature, I should say, in its own right. Unlike, unfortunately, Halak's work, which isn't. I wish it was. I'm going on about this again. So it had this kind of literary as well as a political and emotional and paradigm shifting potency, which is borne out by its enduring popularity in university courses and in the general public. And I think credit should be given. What I'm trying to say is credit should be given where it's due. And as we heap criticism on him for not realizing these other more critical things, a la Kant, as I put it, I think we shouldn't forget that. In other words, his name should be inscribed in the Hall of Fame, regardless of his shortcomings. And I just wanted to give him his due, despite everything you're saying. And let us not forget that he did. He was a milestone for many of us in our consciousness of the world. And that is a remarkable achievement for a human being to do, despite everything else.
No, it's true. And I think Halak would agree with that. In fact, you know, when he describes in the introduction as his project is to hijack Said's ship and to take it to an even better mission, right? Halak is not going to burn the ship down. Right, he understands the ship as being salvageable, but you know, there's a line by I think Al Mutanabbi, "ولم يرى في عيوبنا شيء كنقص القادرين على التمام." Says that there's no shortcoming in human beings quite like the failure to reach one's own potential. Right, and so I think that Halak, as a Palestinian, you know, as someone, you know, and due to the hegemony of both Orientalism, Sa'id's version of Orientalism, and let's say the entire sort of identity politics that it has spawned, how entrenched it is, I feel like that's why Halaq is being so stern about it. That, you know, just like if you were entrenched in a pre-Orientalism world, like you never read Oriental, you never read Sa'id before, and then Orientalism comes and sort of like, you know, capsizes your boat. I see Halaq as wanting to do that again to the person who has read Sa'id and understands Sa'idian Orientalism, but they're bumping around in the incoherence of it. They're not, you know, as again, my advisor said, they're throwing a stone at the issue as opposed to really, really doing the work that needs to be done.
I get all that. It was more of a personal phrase for him as a man who transformed the thinking and worldview of literally millions of people. And it's very rare for any human being to accomplish such a feat. I'm not denying Wael Hallaq's critique at all. Lest we forget that he is to be commended.
Yes, no, definitely. I agree with that. And that's an important corrective, because when we get into critique mode, you know, we can lose sight of the accolades. But ironically, even those accolades demonstrate something that Sa'id missed. Like, look at how much he influenced, right? He had that authorial moment where that work did achieve something in the discourse. It intervened, it changed.
It continues to bear fruit.
Yeah, exactly. So to bring us home for today, or to bring us to the end of the chapter, this is essentially due to, as Halaq has pointed out throughout this chapter, that if we conceptualize Orientalism as merely representational, that this is what sort of limits us in our ability to really, really put our finger on what is responsible for modern violence, what is responsible for European violence, what is responsible for colonialism in the unique sense of the word, not the old classical sort of sense, right? If Orientalism is merely representational, we're kind of at a dead end. There's not really a lot to do. You know, we have to get into this game of almost like tokenization. Who's going to speak for the Orient? Who's like really representing it, or who's not, or let's not even represent it at all. If we open our minds and see that rather speech is performative, and he gives the example of the I do at a marriage ceremony, right? It's like I do is not just a representation of how you feel. It enacts juridicality. Your legal status changes, right? Like all these sorts of things, that speech is performative. It creates the reality. You can refuse what you are. You can build up what you want to be to an extent. That we're able to some extent, enact reality with the sort of power, then we sort of see that there's something else going on, much more deep, much more structural, that's responsible for the elimination of epistemes, worldviews, cultures, languages, ways of living, right, that has continued to this very second, that we need to really take seriously and understand fully and precisely if we want to find a way out, if we want to develop a strategy and tactics that are going to help us get out of this and stop this sort of thing, then we need to understand precisely what is at the issue. And that sets us up for the rest of the book.
Excellent. No, indeed. That's very good. Very good summary, indeed. Thank you. Thanks very much indeed, Imam Tom, for giving us your very concise summary. And You take the cover off, don't you?
I always do. I really despise those jackets.
Anyway, I'm going to show you the cover. This is it, Restating Orientalism. And apparently the real title to focus on is A Critique of Modern Knowledge. And that's the back cover, praise for the book, published by Columbia. It's an amazing work. And so thank you very much. I really look forward to discussing or hearing you discuss the rest of the work, which I must plow on myself. I've not read much of it, actually, but very, very juicy indeed. So thank you very much indeed, Imam Tom.
Thank you always for the opportunity.
Till next time.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.